The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Thanks. Good afternoon. I am Steve Vladeck. I'm an associate professor here at American. For those of you who didn't realize that I was the subject of Dan's mock-in toward the end of the previous panel. First, let me thank you all for sticking around. I know it's late on a Friday and raining, which in D.C. usually means bad traffic and therefore staying home. I also want to thank Dan, Ken Anderson, Ben Wittes, and Brookings for helping us co-sponsor and put on this event, and Jennifer Dobson and our entire special event staff for all of their efforts today. I think this has really been a great conversation, and I think it's been a fun event, and hopefully we will never, ever have to do it again. It's primary season, and so I hope you will indulge me in making one controversial prediction about this super thing in a few days, Giants 27, Patriots 24. There are no Patriots fans on this panel, I'm pleased to say, although I was terrified to learn that Andrew McCarthy is a Jets fan. But I won't hold that against him. Anyway, exactly. Perhaps, speaking of things controversial, I think perhaps the most controversial aspect, although perhaps not the most complicated aspect, of the National Security Court proposals is the idea that national security courts might function as a substitute for criminal prosecutions, either for Article III criminal trials, for military commissions, or for both. And I think, per Judge Brinkema's discussion at lunchtime, I think in many ways this is perhaps the most riveting part of this debate, and I think it's also the most polarizing part of this debate. And so whereas Elisa said in the last panel that the detention question may be the trickiest, I think this is probably the loudest. And so to help us frame the issues, I want to sort of suggest three sets of questions that I think are not unique to the debate over national security courts for criminal prosecution, but are sort of specifically at issue here. The first question, which I think is the elephant in the room all day today, is the necessity question. Right? Do we need national security courts? Are there reasons why the current system of Article III criminal trials for some people, military commissions for some people, is not working? Do we need military commissions at all, I think, is even embedded within that question as well. The second question, or the second series of questions, we might describe as jurisdictional questions. Who should be tried by these national security courts? What should they be tried for? Who should make the decision about whether someone is eligible for trial by a national security court or not? You know, what kind of offenses should the national security court have jurisdiction over? And then the third set of questions, I mean, I think it's sort of typical of a common law professor to suggest that this comes last, are the procedural and evidentiary questions. What are the procedures going to be? What are the rules of evidence? How different are things going to be from what we might think of as the normal process? And if they're not that different from the normal process, why deviate from the normal process in the first place? I think these are all sort of intermingled within the conversation we'll have over the next hour and a half. And we have three veterans, I think none of whom would ever stoop so low as to claim to be academics, from the trenches, who are going to be helping us with these questions. First is James Baker, all the way to my right. Mr. Baker is formerly the Counsel for Intelligence Policy at the U.S. Department of Justice, where he was one of the senior officials involved in proceedings before the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. Jim's comments today will focus, I think, largely on the FISA process, the FISA procedures, and how they may or may not map onto other types of proceedings. To Jim's left is Andrew McCarthy. Andrew McCarthy is the director of the Center for Law and Counterterrorism at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Andrew is a prolific author who has written dozens, if not maybe hundreds, of articles and monographs about terrorism, national security-related issues, including perhaps the most thorough paper about why we need a national security court, which you can find at tab 8 of the lovely green packet. Professionally, he was the Assistant U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York for 18 years, including a central role in prosecuting the blind sheikh, Omar Rahman, in the, what we unfortunately now refer to as the first World Trade Center trial. And he also did a stint in 2004 as a special assistant to the Deputy Secretary of Defense. To Andy McCarthy's left is Andy Patel. We sort of are running on Andy's on this panel. Andy is a private criminal defense lawyer in Manhattan who has, I dare say, decades of experience with high-profile cases, including terrorism cases. He defended El Sayed Nasser at the Rahman trial, so he and Andy McCarthy go way back. And has spent much of the last 6 years representing Jose Padilla, although I think you have now moved out of your apartment in Miami?
Yes, almost.
And so I look forward to what each of them have to say, starting with Jim Baker. Thank you.
Okay, does this work? Can people hear me? Okay, good. That's a good thing. I know how to work microphones, so that's a good deal. That's an inside joke. Okay, I would like to just talk about the FISA process for a little bit and explain how the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court works and give my perspective on that, and if we have a chance at the end, I'll double back to some of the questions pertinent to this panel in terms of using a national security court with respect to criminal prosecutions, but we might be able to save that to the end. So let me just be quick and try to just highlight a few things. Some of this you may be familiar with if you've dealt with the FISA process before. Others of you may not have, so just bear with me. So in some ways, although things have changed a little bit since revelations with respect to the terrorist surveillance program, but generally speaking, in the past, my experience was that FISA was the statute that everybody loved to hate, and people hated it for a variety of different reasons, and I'll try to flesh some of that out as we go here. But my assessment is that actually the statute works quite well, and that the FISA court works quite well. Basically, what is the FISA court? The FISA court is 11 sitting district court judges. They are regular district court judges selected from around the country. Three of them are from the local area, usually from Washington, D.C. or the Eastern District of Virginia. They are selected for assignment on the FISA court by the Chief Justice of the United States. They sit for terms of 7 years. They can't be renewed. They can't go back on the court after they've served their term. They sit in Washington, D.C. They hear applications from the United States. I'll come back to that in a second, but it's in Washington, D.C. Generally speaking, judges will have a duty week, so a judge who's from Arizona, perhaps, will fly into Washington for a week, hear all the cases, and then go back to Arizona. If there are cases that have to be heard over the weekend or a holiday or something like that, as I say, there's the three local judges that we can go to. The judges, there's one judge per application, and I'll talk about what applications are in a second, but it's basically one judge per application. It's not a three-judge panel. They generally don't sit en banc. It's very much, in that sense, similar to what happens with respect to a Title III application, Title III being the wiretap application in criminal cases. The court's jurisdiction is statutorily set out in the FISA statute, and it covers applications by the United States for electronic surveillance, for physical search, for pen registers and trap and trace devices, and for business records. The court also has a role with respect to reviewing and approving procedures under the relatively new Protect America Act that was enacted back in August and was just extended for about two more weeks while Congress considers amendments to the statute. So the key thing there is that their jurisdiction is confined by the statute. They are not a court that sits for all purposes with respect to national security matters. They hear applications and rule on applications or rule on procedures of a certain type as defined by the statute. The court currently sits inside the Department of Justice building. That's for security reasons. That's for historical reasons. It's been there since the court was created back in the 70s. They are moving. They will move to a different location in a courthouse in D.C., relatively soon, in the courthouse in D.C. relatively soon. The court, in terms of hearing an application from the United States, the sessions, again, they're similar in some respects to what happens when a district court judge hears a Title III application anywhere in the United States. So you have the judge, you have the court clerk, typically you'll have the court's legal counsel present in a conference room, it looks like a conference room, it's got a big table in it, and present at the hearing are the folks from the court that I just mentioned. You also have an attorney from my old office, the Office of Intelligence Policy and Review, which is now part of the National Security Division at the Department of Justice. You'll have the affiant there, who will typically be an FBI agent or a representative from the National Security Agency. You may have a lawyer from that agency present at the same time. The proceedings are all ex parte. They are all in camera. The court has issued more than 20,000, or made, approved 20,000 or so applications since its inception. It's only published three opinions in all that time. So most of the material that comes out of the court, most of the decisions from the court are done in camera ex parte, and they're classified. Applications themselves, OIPR, as I say, files them on behalf of the intelligence community. You have legal standards that you have to meet inside the in the applications. We have a factual recitation that's part of the application that lays out why the group that's being targeted is a foreign power and why the individual target is an agent of a foreign power, and sets forth all the other information that you have to have. But that's the essence of the application. It's a signed affidavit submitted by the government. Every application has to be approved by the Attorney General or the Deputy Attorney General or the Acting Attorney General or the Assistant Attorney General for National Security. So it's a very limited group of people that can approve these applications. Each application also has to have a certification from a high-ranking official with national security responsibilities from the executive branch. Typically, it'll be somebody like the Director of the FBI, the Secretary of Defense, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, someone like that. Government does win, if you can view it that way, most cases, high percentage of the cases. Very few applications, and I don't remember the number off the top of my head, it's very, very small. Number of applications have been disapproved in the past. Notwithstanding that, there was a very famous incident a few years ago regarding the so-called wall and the division between law enforcement and intelligence authorities, in which all seven judges of the FISA court declined or did not agree with the government's position and refused to go along with it, and that resulted in the first ever appeal to the FISA Court of Review. There's only been that one appeal, and the FISA Court was reversed on that, and that's a whole subject of another panel discussion. So I guess I would say my view is, and obviously I worked on the system for a long period of time. I got there in 1996. I think the success rate is a function of two things, mainly hard work by the government to get it right. But obviously, again, I'm biased, and you don't have to believe that. But that's what I think. And also that probable cause is actually a much more flexible standard than you would think, and that some folks have made it out to be. It is a workable standard in my view. OIPR, in terms of figuring out what applications to file and how it's all going to be done, works continually and very closely with the intelligence community to set priorities and to take the most important cases to the court as soon as possible. When a person is tried in a criminal case and we want to use FISA information with respect to that person, there's a whole process that we go through in the district courts that, again, I think has worked very well, very satisfactorily in terms of protecting the equities, the intelligence equities of the government, and at the same time providing due process to the defendant. It's been successful in every court in which it's been used so far, and every court that's ruled on it has found that the procedure for using FISA materials in a criminal case is constitutional. It's defeated a whole range of every conceivable constitutional challenge. So let me just, in just a very couple minutes here, throw out a few things that I think are lessons with respect to the FISA court that should be considered when we're evaluating whether we need a national security court or not, and would such a thing work, without saying whether we should actually do it. But let me just throw out a few things. Number one is I do think that the system does work. It's not perfect, and I'll come back to that in a second. In the sense of it working, though, it has produced a large volume of actionable foreign intelligence over a prolonged period of time, and actionable meaning information that we can do something with today to stop a threat. And so I think it's produced a huge amount of that and been very successful during wartime. The FISA process also does protect sensitive sources and methods. That is critical. We have never had a FISA application disclosed to a defendant, and there's never been a leak from the FISA court. It's been a very successful system in protecting sources and methods. Again, I submit that, contrary to what some have said, it's not a Potemkin village. It is a real court with real judges, with real lawyers making hard decisions and taking their jobs seriously. And I think that's critical for people to understand. From the government's perspective, it's highly beneficial because we go to a court, we get an order, and we can tell a company to assist us. And so we get the benefit of being able to compel them to do what we want them to do, and they get the benefit of having an order and having liability protection. So everybody in the system, in that sense, is satisfied with the end result. In addition, I would submit that the process and the statute is consistent with American laws and values. There's general public acceptance now, especially that's been much more examined in the past couple of years, that that this is a good system in terms of trying to balance individual rights and the need to protect national security. The participants in the system also have the comfort of knowing that what they're doing is lawful, and it's pursuant to an act of Congress. And so an important effect of that is that there's no incentive to leak. People feel comfortable with what they're doing. They don't worry about it. They know it's okay. And so there's no incentive to say, I don't feel right about this. What should I do? I might not be able to go to anybody up the food chain to complain about something, so maybe I'll leak it to the press because I want something done about it. There's no incentive to do that. The information obtained from a FISA can be used for any lawful purpose. It can be disseminated widely throughout the government, and as I said, it can be used as evidence in a criminal case. An important thing to remember in terms of the success of the system is that the people in the system matter, and I think that's true with any operation of government. It's the people in the system that make it work. The people in the system have to want to make it work, and so they have to be diligent and good public servants. They have to be competent and understand an arcane area of the law. And they have to have a high degree of integrity. They have to be willing to say no to a variety of other government officials that urge them to do something. And so you need all that together to make this system work. The system there are costs to the system. Let me just lay out a few of them. It does slow down, in some instances, the initiation of collection of foreign intelligence information. Now, we could have a whole long discussion about that. Suffice it to say that if you have to go to a group of lawyers and you have to go to a court and get the approval of the Attorney General and so on, as I've described, it's not the same as an FBI agent or somebody at the NSA just being able to initiate surveillance on their own and boom, they go forward. So there are costs in terms of that. What I would say is that we have, as I said, we've worked closely with the intelligence community to try to minimize that as much as possible or shorten that delay as much as possible and to do the most important cases first. And so I think sometimes when you hear complaints about the FISA system not working fast, it's from folks whose work or whose cases have been assessed by the intelligence community to not be of as high a priority as some other cases. Fleshing out a little bit what I've talked about before, the system is resource intensive. To make this thing work, it costs money. Lawyers cost money, guess what? It is hard work. The participants have to want to make it work. The intelligence community must prioritize its work. It cannot leave the prioritization of the work to the lawyers. That's just a bad way to operate. And not everything can be done at once. Again, with respect to this, the speed of collection, the intelligence community does have a limited capacity to be able to absorb, process, analyze, and disseminate information. So in terms of the volume of collection, as I say, we could have a long debate about that. And just in terms of the financial costs also, OIPR, when I got there in 96, we had about 6 lawyers doing intelligence operations, which means all these FISA applications. Our overall budget for the office was about $1 million. When I left, we had about 100 lawyers, and the budget was $30 million. And that's still not enough people to do everything that the office is called upon to do. So with that, I will stop and wait for additional questions. But that's a quick overview.
Thanks very much, and thank you so much for the invitation to be here. I'm sorry I couldn't be here this morning, but the last panel was terrific and really illuminating. The last time Andy Patel and I were together in a setting like this, we were commenting before, our now college students were toddlers, and FISA was an outrageous violation of the Fourth Amendment rather than the thin line between us and the destruction of the Fourth Amendment. So I guess things really do change. And they do change. And I guess I could actually do this panel by myself because to the extent that there's... What I mean is that to the extent there are 3 sides of this question, I've been on all of them. It's been a journey, and I still don't know where it comes out or where it ought to come out. When I caught the investigation that became the prosecution of the blind sheik and a number of his underlings, including Andy's client, for seditious conspiracy against the United States. It was an article of faith in the Justice Department, and it was one that I bought onto 1,000,000%, that it was extremely important for us to take these people who were our enemies, who attempted to commit real atrocities and kill thousands of us, and treat them with the full flower of due process that we would treat any other defendant with, so that at the end of the proceeding, we could hold our heads up and say, this is a result that has integrity, this is something that we can be proud of, this is a real measure of who we are as a people, that we would take our worst enemies and treat them with that kind of dignity and that kind of process. I not only thought that was important, it was a source of pride. It was a reason to get up every day in what was a very difficult proceeding and carry on. The problem is that your ideal crashes into the day-to-day reality of trying to carry that mission out. My reflection over what was really a three-year journey in trying to do this is that as important as the ideal seemed, it seemed to me some days that what we were doing was actually crazy. Because while we were dealing with a phenomenon that we certainly didn't understand in 1993 the way we understand it today, and that's not to suggest that we have anything close to perfect understanding of it, but while we were realizing that this challenge, this threat, was bigger, broader, more organized, and more dangerous than even we suspected it was after the 1993 bombing. What we were also doing is giving boatloads of information to the defendants. And even though you do turn over that kind of information with, you know, all kinds of bells and whistles on it about how it's only to be used for preparation for trial and it's not to be further disseminated and all the things that we say, in point of fact, not everybody is honorable, and a lot of that information unfortunately gets out and it gets into the hands of people who it shouldn't be in the hands of. I often tell the story of our co-conspirator list, which we turned over, I guess it was about a week before the trial. Under Second Circuit law, because defense counsel don't have enough information strictly in the four corners of an indictment to prepare for what the government's case will be, I think the law in the Second Circuit is pretty much the same as it is the rest of the country. The government is generally required to turn over a list of unindicted co-conspirators, which is everybody who's on your radar. Our list, I think, had about 200 people and entities on it, which could have been everybody from, you know, the pizza man who we saw a bunch of phone calls to but hadn't yet figured out that he was completely innocent, to the Sudanese mission to the United Nations in New York, which actually sought to help some of our conspirators carry out a bombing of the United Nations complex, to Osama bin Laden, which I think is the first mention on an official government document of any kind, that, at least that I know of his name. We didn't know much about him at the time, but we knew enough to put him on the list. He was, so far as we understood, a shady Saudi financier of terrorism, but we didn't have much more information than that. The point here is that that's a very valuable piece of information. If you want to get out of the mode of a legal analyst or a lawyer and just think of it as a piece of intelligence information in a struggle between two different sides, giving that information over to the other side, and we did, by the way, learn that it got to bin Laden in the Sudan, tells him everybody who is on the government's radar screen in terms of suspicion. If you think that intelligence is more important in terms of your security than the outcome of any particular trial, what it tells somebody who receives it is, if I'm only talking to two or three different people, maybe one of them is a government informant. If I'm only having meetings in this one or two places that I think are secure, maybe I should change my locations. If I'm using particular telephones, maybe I need to get off those phones. It's a very valuable piece of information to turn over to the defense, and it was not singular. The problem with terrorism trials is not just, I don't think, a discovery problem. Ordinarily, we talk about this in terms of all the stuff that you have to give over in a criminal trial. And it's true. I mean, you have to give, in a criminal trial, you have to turn over all the statements of the witnesses, all the statements that you have, even of some people who aren't going to be witnesses if their hearsay statements come in. You have to turn over documentary information in your possession that may be material to the preparation of the defense. And material tends to be in the eye of the beholder, depending on how clever the defense lawyer is in explaining what is material and how expansive the judge's sense of what fair play is in a particular litigation. In a death penalty, you have to comply with Brady, of course, which means not only turning over any information that's actually exculpatory, but anything that could be used by the defense to refute the government's theory of guilt, even if it's not.
Not on its face exculpatory. In a death penalty case, you have to turn over not only information that's exculpatory, but any information that might persuade the judge, persuade the jury not to vote the death penalty. And if you think about that, some of that information can actually be inculpatory. If you have somebody who wants to make a defense of the fact that he was just a pawn in a larger organization, you might end up actually having to turn over a lot of information that actually shows the person is guilty, but might persuade the jury that the death penalty isn't appropriate. So you're in a position at the beginning of the trial to turn over a lot of information in accordance with the rules. I think something that's very much unseen, because it's not something you can open up a rule book and see, but is nevertheless extremely real to people who actually are in the practice of trying cases, is that a trial has a certain dynamic, and it has a certain rhythm. And in terms of what your disclosure obligations are, it isn't limited to what is written in the rules or even written in the cases about the rules. What ends up happening in any trial, and this is a terrorism trial, this counts to a fairly well, I think, because they tend to be such big mega trials. I think the one we had was about 9 months. Most of them in New York in the 90s, I think, went at least 5 months. Everybody is invested, at least on the government side and I think the court side, everyone is invested in getting the proceeding to a conclusion. And what ends up happening is once the trial starts, it becomes clear that at least some of the defendants are probably guilty. And nobody on the government, and certainly no one in the court, wants to do anything that would cause the case to have to be done over again, given the amount of resources that are poured into it and how difficult these trials are. And these are trials, unlike the general run of cases, that not only involve often complex issues, but have security challenges attendant to them that are not features in other cases. You have to protect the courthouse, you have to protect the harden the holding facilities, the judicial personnel, the prosecutors, sometimes the defense lawyers, in fact, often the defense lawyers, I should say, the defendants themselves. This is a major investment of resources. And what that visits on everyone as the trial continues is the need to try to get it to the end and get it finished with some finality. That incentivizes you as the prosecutor to go to the court more often than you would in the normal case and say, because you want to be able to have a show of good faith later on in the record, I don't think I need to turn this over, but I want you, Your Honor, to take a look at it, just to make sure, because your margin for error, as you're in a case like this, is less than it would be in the normal case. The incentive is also then on the court to turn over more information than the rules might ordinarily require, because the court doesn't want to get the proceeding reversed any more than the government does. So I think the way the dynamic of the case works out, you end up turning over much more information than even the rules require. And those decisions end up being made not by somebody whose main concern is what the national security of the United States might require. It's decisions made both on the bench side and on the government side by people whose first responsibility is the successful conclusion of the case on the prosecution side, and on the court side, making sure everybody has as much due process as it appears is required under the circumstances. You end up having to turn over a lot of intelligence. And the interesting thing, the way this debate plays out to me, is that most of the forums that we discuss this in are forums like this one. They tend to be in law schools or law school-type settings, and they're dominated by lawyers and legal scholars and practitioners. What that ends up meaning, I think, is that the quantum of due process that comes out of these trials is much more of an important issue than what might be more important to the society, which is how well are we protecting ourselves? How well are we protecting the national security of the United States? And I think it's noteworthy that in those cases in the 1990s, during a period of time when there's a consensus that Al-Qaeda and its affiliates were growing larger and attacks over time were becoming more audacious, we managed to prosecute only 29 people for terrorism in the United States. And most of those 29 came out of the World Trade Center bombing. There was no prosecution in connection, for example, with the coal bombing. There was no prosecution in connection with, or even an indictment, in connection with Khobar Towers. So you're taking out a very minimal number of, you're taking out a very minimal number of people, and with a handful of exceptions, they tend to be the lowest ranking members of the enterprise that you're trying to come to grips with. Osama bin Laden is a fairly good example of this, I think. He was indicted in the United States in June of 1998. That's before the embassy bombings, before the coal bombing, and before 9/11. Now, obviously, we're in a different enforcement paradigm, and we're no longer taking a position that the Department of Justice is the entirety of the counterterrorism sphere. But it does say something about how well we were protecting the country versus how well we were according due process to say that we had a rising threat and we were able to do very, very little about it over a course of 8 years. Let me just say two quick things and I'll sit down. I went from, because for practical reasons, I think, from the ideal to being frightened by the way the process worked, and that led me to think that we needed to have a third way of doing it. My main reason for thinking that is really more of a practical one than a legal one. And by the way, I don't think there's a chance on God's green earth, short of either another terrorist attack or perhaps the next round of litigation about the tribunals in front of the D.C. Circuit when we start to get some rulings and start to get some real hard information about what's been going on in these military proceedings. I don't think there's any chance or any stomach for what you'd need to do to have a national security court. But the reason I think it ultimately may be important to do is because in the out years, we are likely to continue to capture people who are a threat to us outside the United States. And even if I personally think, as I do, that the military paradigm may work fine, the fact that something is legally fine and might satisfy all of our due process and constitutional concerns doesn't make any difference if it turns out that other countries whose cooperation we need in securing ourselves are not going to cooperate with that kind of a system because they regard it as a unilateral executive branch show. I think that's just practical reality. People are not going to be extradited to a system that is unilaterally controlled by the executive branch. And for that reason, I think we need to tweak the system a bit. We certainly, I think, need to get Article III judges who know how to, you know, have shown again and again that they know how to move these cases. But we have to have measures in there that can protect the intelligence that we need, because really, if you think about it, intelligence is the only weapon we have in this war. We can't conquer territory. We can't steal treasure. Our one asset is knowing who the terrorists are, trying to figure out what they're likely to hit next. And we have to, in terms of security, which is our first responsibility, not due process, security, we have to do what we can do to protect that intelligence.
Does this thing work? Can you folks hear me? I'm going to stand up because I'm old and my knees hurt. And sitting here watching four people talking heads has got to be boring as the day is long. Andy McCarthy and I spent 9 months together in a courtroom. Andy is one of the few prosecutors in this country who actually prosecuted what we in the defense bar call real terrorists, as opposed to faux terrorists, which is most of what's going on. But I want to talk about the 800-pound gorilla that Bob Chesney hinted at, a couple of other people have hinted at, and that is, who the hell are we fighting? And until we figure that out, we are essentially the blind wise men who've been sent to examine the elephant. And we may accurately describe that little part which comes into our limited view, but we're going to miss the big picture. And the big picture is whether you call it radical fundamentalism or political Islam, it is a different worldview. I don't have the answer, but we have got to come, hello, to some way of figuring out how to coexist. In my opinion, whether you call something, kick the floor again, that seemed to work. That work? Yeah, which one of these works? Okay, this one. All right. As far as I'm concerned, the reality of the situation, if you're in a criminal justice setting or in a military setting, you are essentially talking about a reactive kind of thing. Until we marginalize the crazies, we're going to be in trouble. If you look at Pakistan alone, a nation of 150 million people, where some of the poli-sci people tell me that approximately 20% would vote in a free and fair election for the Islamists, that's 30 million people in one nuclear state. To the folks who were talking about detention earlier, 30 million, detain that. That's just in one country. We are talking on simply enormous scale. But I've sort of gotten out of my area of expertise because I'm just a criminal lawyer. And I just sort of, you know, I don't go out and arrest people. I just sort of deal with what comes along. The criminal justice system is really sort of in my opinion, the criminal justice system and the military system work very well to do separate functions. The FISA court that was described earlier, there's an interest, you know, the FISA court, I think there were four applications that were initially rejected and on resubmission were approved. So the government is batting about 1,000% in the FISA court. Every criminal defense lawyer that I know of who's had a FISA case has challenged everything you could imagine there is to challenge about it. let me just back up 1 minute. When the government gets a Title III warrant, that is your regular old eavesdropping warrant, you get, as part of the discovery that Mr. McCarthy was describing, you get the application and the probable cause, and you can challenge that probable cause. When you have a FISA wire, what you get is a one-page affirmation from the Attorney General saying that it would be a threat to the security of the United States to disclose that. No judge has turned over a FISA application so that a defense attorney could even challenge the basis for the probable cause. There's one semi-exception to that rule, and that is the Holy Land case that was being prosecuted in Dallas, Texas this past summer. And it was not the court that turned it over, but the government itself that accidentally turned it over. And although FISA things are one of those things that are, shall we say, born classified. No one was going to tell me exactly what was in it, but it's been described as being chock full of Brady material. And considering that that case went to jury and resulted in not a single conviction, there seems to be some merit to that. I think what we have to be concerned about is that FISA does not become so simple that it becomes a way of evading Article III and an actual open. And I think that's the real value of the criminal justice system, is that people can see what's going on. They can see their government in action. I also want to just say one thing about the role of defense counsel in this. There's been a lot of discussion that one of the things that's really been important here today or in this conflict, and it is a conflict, is intelligence and how to get it. In the Padilla case, when we were in the writ stage, the government filed an affirmation from Lloyd Jacoby, Vice Admiral Jacoby, who was the acting head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, essentially saying that it would be a threat to the national security of the United States for me to meet with my client. No one's ever said it quite that directly before. In rejecting that claim, although he didn't quite say it as bluntly as I'm about to say, Judge McCasey, now Attorney General McCasey, essentially said, if you want to find out what this guy's got to say, let his lawyers go in and talk to him. The great urban myth of all this is that if you get lawyers in there, they're going to tell people not to talk. I've spent hundreds, if not thousands, of hours with people with terrorists. No way around that. They are. They've been convicted of it. But they're people. And people tend to do things eventually, no matter, what their religious zeal, eventually a certain degree of self-interest kicks in. If you have somebody who's facing infinite detention, no matter what he does, you're going to have some problems motivating him to talk. But if you have someone who says, you can say, hey, if you cooperate, see the light, you're going to get a 5K letter, and who knows what's going to happen, but it's going to be better than what else. In our trial, there were at least two cooperators. Mr. Hagag cooperated, and I hate to say it, but it's been 15 years, so I don't quite remember how many. But one of the people that's really of more concern is somebody you don't hear a lot about, is a guy named Ali Mohammed, who was indicted as part of the embassy bombing case. And we found about Ali Mohammed because when Mr. Nosair was arrested, he was living in New Jersey, and the New Jersey State Police went into his house, and it would be inaccurate to say they took everything that wasn't nailed down, because they actually took some stuff that was nailed down. I think I stand before you, and I think it's fair for me to say that I am the only lawyer who's ever introduced a coloring book at a federal criminal trial.
Without objection.
Because the government knew it was relevant. I can't remember whether I got away with asking the Lieutenant Kane in the New Jersey State Police whether he thought the Sprites and Rainbow Bright were terrorists or not. But one of the things we found in going through these boxes and boxes of stuff that taken from Mr. Nocera's house was some stuff that was very clearly come out of Fort Bragg. And we actually filed a SEPA notice because we didn't know whether it was classified or not. It's, you know, some, one of it was marked, you know, top secret for training only. And one of the things I'm very pleased to be able to say about the members of my community is there have been no leaks of classified material by criminal defense counsel. And there are quite a number of us who've been cleared. And to be perfectly honest, we're just outrageously paranoid about it, you know, because we just, we're sort of in the Caesar's wife position, you know. The U.S. Attorney's Office has people who love to prosecute us, so we just don't, you know, when in doubt, we just say, I don't know, so I got to shut up. Ali Muhammad, in this box of stuff, we found this videotape of this guy who spoke English perfectly with sort of a slight Middle Eastern accent. And he was just raging on, and it sounded exactly like the kind of speeches that Sheikh Rahman made, only his weren't English. We didn't have to read along to get this. And he had been down in Fort Bragg and apparently provided, you know, we were able to prove that he actually went over to Afghanistan and did some training. And he was eventually essentially admitted to helping to plan the embassy bombings. He got a lawyer. He signed a cooperation agreement. And my guess is he's provided enormous amounts of actionable intelligence in the criminal justice system. I have a feeling that Steve's about to tell me it's time for me to sit down and shut up, so I'll do that in advance.
Andy's been stealing my lines for, like, what, 6 years, 7 years?
Yeah.
That's three presentations. I'm not quite sure how to sum up in one or two sentences. So I'm not going to try, although I wouldn't have thought that Andy McCarthy would reassure me and Andy Patel would scare the crap out of me. I would have thought it would be the other way around. I guess I have a series of questions which I'll put to the panel and then hopefully open it up to questions from the audience. I guess my first question I think goes to all three of you, although I think it probably goes most specifically to Jim. And the question is, most of the proposals that we, or most of the sort of more concrete proposals we hear for national security courts, either in the detention or the criminal prosecution context, involve at least many, if not most, parallels to FISA. That FISA is the process with which we're the most familiar. It best sort of balances the rights of the subject with the government's interest in keeping things secret and investigating what's going on, or at least that's the line from those who support national security courts. The question I have, before I get in any further trouble, is whether FISA's utility might best be understood as being warrant-specific, and that the notion that there is a special process that is defended on the ground that it works, that it's there's legal standards, it can be done in secret, it can be kept a secret, is that really capable of being extrapolated into criminal prosecutions writ large, or does that sort of take advantage of unique characteristics of obtaining a search warrant. Because it seems like if there is a serious call to create some kind of national security criminal process, you know, perhaps the starting point is what current processes can we borrow from and how well can we borrow from them?
Well, I guess one, there's several ways to think about that, and just to be as concise as possible. The FISA court today is built to deal with applications for electronic surveillance or search and the other ones that I talked about. So these judges, when they're in town, as I mentioned, they are very busy. And do the court today is not big enough to sort of just take on this additional role. So you have to think of some kind of a court that's either analogous to that or more judges or something different. But this court is quite busy. So that's point number one. Point number two, as I said before, it works, but it works for what it is assigned to do, which is deal with these warrant applications. And whether you can take that and make sort of secret, semi-secret criminal trials is a separate question. But let me just go back and try to bring in a few pieces that maybe some in the audience might not be familiar with. I mean, Andy, the other Andy, brought up the FISA litigation. And so just to keep in mind, there's different moving parts here, okay, so when you're dealing with the kinds of trials that we're talking about here. So on the one hand, FISA has within it its own mechanism for protecting from disclosure to the public and to anybody else who shouldn't see it, the actual FISA applications. And I'll come back to the Brady question if I have time. But there's a mechanism under FISA for protecting the applications. Typically speaking, the fruits of the intercepts, the actual phone calls, the actual emails that are intercepted, whatever it is that's collected, microphones, whatever, the fruits of the surveillance, that will be handed over to the defendant and his legal team, and they will be able to go through the fruits of it and see what it was that was intercepted. What they don't get to see under FISA, that's different from Title III, is they don't get to see the application. On top of that, when you're dealing with one of these kinds of cases, you've also got a whole other legal regime that we haven't really talked about, which is the Classified Information Procedures Act, CIPA. And CIPA governs really everything that's classified but is not the FISA applications. And so with respect to one of these cases, there may be lots and lots of material inside the intelligence community that's relevant in one way or another. Either it's inculpatory evidence that we want to use, we the government want to use, or it's exculpatory or it's relevant material in some other way. And that should be disclosed, or at least somebody has to think about whether to disclose it or not. And so you've got this whole separate legal regime called CIPA that you have to apply, generally speaking, in most of these cases. So you've got different things moving on. So I think the key question is that system, you know, that's the system that we have today to deal with the use of classified information in criminal cases, and is that adequate? Is it too burdensome? And so on. Generally speaking, it has worked. I mean, I think the assessment has been that a trial conducted under these statutory regimes does provide adequate due process to the defendants and has withstood criminal challenge. The question is whether it also, at the same time, protects the interests of the executive branch with respect to, does it actually allow us to protect national security information? Are there some times when we have information in our files that we would really use to sort of flatten this case? It's just absolutely concrete evidence that this person is guilty, but we can't use it because it comes from a sensitive source, it comes from a sensitive collection technique, and we're not going to charge the case in a way that puts that classified information at issue at all. We just don't want to disclose that, and we're not going to do it. So sometimes the government will shape the charges so that we don't put that stuff at issue. In addition, you know, every person, I mean, notwithstanding what Andy P. said, notwithstanding the fact that there's been, I'm unaware of any disclosures by defense attorneys, but nevertheless, the more people that know a secret, the more risk there is of disclosing, of having it disclosed publicly or to the defendants. And sometimes the intelligence community or information that we obtain from foreign governments that comes into the intelligence community and that's relevant to one of these cases, we're just not going to be in a position to disclose it. And so you put the executive branch in a difficult position of having to make a decision about, are we going to bring this case or not? Are we going to bring the maximum charges that we want to bring or not? And it becomes a very difficult conundrum for the government.
Yeah, I see this almost the opposite, I guess, because I'm not a fan of FISA. And what I like about a national security court that I don't like about FISA is I think in a national security court, if you had Article III judges, they would be performing the traditional role that judges perform and that judges are particularly good at, whereas in FISA, they are performing a role that they are not that they're not designed to perform in our system. I talk about a 1948 opinion by Justice Jackson in the Chicago Southern case, where, and I think it's relevant to mention that it's Justice Jackson because we're talking about somebody who was a giant both in the political branches and also a renowned justice of the Supreme Court. What Jackson says in Chicago Southern is two things that are important. Number one, judges are not, in his words, competent to perform an oversight role as far as the collection of intelligence is concerned. There's nothing about being a judge, even a prominent lawyer of any kind, that makes you particularly competent to perform that role, which is a different discipline. The FISA court is obviously an effort to get over that hump. I mean, the whole idea in the FISA court was that we would house all these national security surveillance issues in one court with a handful of judges who would deal with this again and again and therefore develop, manufacture the expertise that Justice Jackson was talking about lacking. The problem is that FISA does not and cannot answer the other point that is raised by Justice Jackson, which is that the decisions about how to collect and who to collect national security information on, intelligence information, are not by nature legal decisions. They're political decisions. And the way our system is designed, there is supposed to be an accountability nexus between the people who make those decisions and the people whose lives are affected by those decisions. And what FISA does is it takes the collection of national security intelligence and it puts it in the control of the most insulated, least accountable branch. So that, for example, if you have a FISA judge who, like a FISA judge evidently did in 2007, throws out 30 years of FISA practice and says, you know what, from now on you have to come to the FISA court not only to get a warrant in cases where your targets are in the United States, but if you have a terrorist in Afghanistan trying to talk to a terrorist in Iraq, you've got to come to us for permission for that too. Now, that's a radical departure in American law and in the collection of foreign intelligence surveillance. We haven't been able to find out who the judge's name is who made the decision. We haven't been able to read the decision. We haven't been able to see what the reasoning is. Imagine for a moment that, you know, President Bush, you know, suddenly decided, this would be shocking, I know, to do something in secret. The hue and cry of that, and we've seen it again and again and again, and yet here we have really a monumental development in our intelligence apparatus, something which if it applies actually will collapse the whole apparatus because there's no way that we can get applications for thousands and thousands of foreign communications. That's the reason when they wrote FISA that they carved those out. Because they knew that that was not something that we wanted to bring into the control of the courts. And yet, we've had a really revolutionary decision, and there hasn't been a peep about it. It's amazing.
On that point, without commenting on the actual decision or anything of that nature, but in terms of what it was, but I mean, let's just remember that that decision, I mean, the decision did come to light fairly quickly because, in fact, a member of Congress discussed it in public and after having been briefed by the executive branch on it. And then thereafter, based on that, there was actually a hue and a cry because Congress very quickly amended the FISA statute to deal with that situation. So there was a way, even though the details of it are not known to the public, Congress came to know about it, or at least a sufficient number of members of Congress came to know about it. So, but your general point is right, though, in the sense that the court, whatever court it is, the FISA court, or if you have some other national security court, there will be some body of classified law that people are not going to know about. And there has to be a willingness on the part of the public to accept that, and I assume it would be subject to review and oversight by Congress of those kinds of decisions.
That's my only point about it. I think there are better ways to do this than to have it done by a separate court. I know we're supposed to be talking about National Security Court, not FISA so much, but there are more accountable ways to do this.
Ed?
I just wanted to say one thing about you can neither legislatively mandate or judicially mandate individual credibility. There are offices that, when I was litigating with Andy for a couple of years, you know, if he called me up and said, it's raining outside, I got an umbrella. That level of credibility, let me just tell you a very quick story. Yasser Hamdi was arrested, seized in Afghanistan, went through some screening process, decided he was the worst of the worst, and he was sent to Guantanamo, and then he was found out to be an American citizen. I don't know how that passed the initial screening point. He was, the powers that be said that this man was too dangerous to be allowed to meet with his lawyer. When the Supreme Court said, yes, he can, and he's entitled to some kind of process, he was released. And actually, I wish he was still here, but Alan Kaufman, who was then the Chief JAG for Joint Forces Command, explained to me that he was released under the concept of military parole. Which goes back to the Napoleonic era. Essentially, Yasser Hamdi, a man too dangerous to meet with a lawyer, was released because he gave his word of honor that he wouldn't be a terrorist for the next 5 years. When that kind of thing is going on, when the government cries wolf, it's hard to sign on.
Do you have a follow-up, or is that?
Just very briefly, this, though, does go to the problem of when you turn your political issues into legal issues. When you're going to argue these things as legal issues, and I'm not going to get into the credibility question. The fact is that lawyers have to argue things at the maximum margins of their authority, because if you don't defend it in one case, then you lose it in the next case when you might actually need it. And part of the craziness of turning your politics into law is that you're forever arguing what the margins of your authority are. And that's the dynamic of the kind of debate.
I have one more short question, and then we'll throw it open to the audience. My one other short question is whether, if you actually look at the meat of some of the proposals, a lot of the critiques of the extant process go to some of the evidentiary issues that Andy described, go to the concerns about potential disclosure of classified information, the story that Judge Mukasey told him in an op-ed about information that made its way back into the terrorist training camps. I guess my question is there something that would not be solved, is there a concern that would not be vitiated, that would not be alleviated by substantive amendments, however, where necessary, to FISA and SEPA, and to adequately funding and providing resources to the courts along the lines of Judge Brinkema's suggestion at lunch that she had logistical support and that helped. What else would be missing from a regime where we were more careful with information at trial, where we were more careful with process, and where we were giving the judges the resources they needed? I guess what would be the challenge that we would still face?
Just two quick points on that. Number one, it's not just about discovery. I mean, if your underlying premise is that there is information that is attendant to the trial process, which if it gets into the hands of the people who are trying to kill you, it will make them more efficient at killing you. You can't handle that just by virtue of tweaking the discovery rules, because the trial process itself, the testimony that comes out in the courtroom, is as edifying as anything that you're going to turn over in discovery. Steve's question earlier about, you know, comparing the FISA court to the normal court, the thing that churns discovery in a case is the adversary process. That's why I think FISA can contain its issues in a way that trial courts can't, because there's no way that you can predict and regulate that that exchange. The second thing I point out is if you're going to do this in the criminal justice system, the Supreme Court says that you have a right to represent yourself. As long as you declare it early enough, we cannot force a lawyer on you. We can do all kinds of things. We can twist your arm. We can try to get you to take a lawyer on, but you do not have to have one. What I was fearful about in our case, and what I've been fearful about ever since, is you're dealing with people who are actually suicide terrorists. And if they're willing to kill themselves in an act of terrorism, I think you'd be kidding yourself if you don't think they'd be willing to give themselves up, content themselves with the fact that they have a much worse chance of getting acquitted if they represent themselves rather than have a lawyer, and say, I want to represent myself, give me the discovery. And then I think you have a real issue. If the information is classified, that doesn't make it any less relevant to the person who is representing somebody at trial. And I think the pro se defendant has a very strong argument that to say, you know, look, I don't care about classified, give me the relevant evidence. That's the only way I get to have a fair trial. Now, what do you do about that? You know, you arrest Zawahiri next week and you decide you're going to bring him into the criminal justice system, and he says, I'm going to represent myself. Give me it all. Give me all your evidence about the Al-Qaeda conspiracy that, you know, that gets triggered by this indictment.
Can I answer that question?
the floor recognizes Judge Brinkema.
But Judge, isn't it also true? I mean, this hasn't been tested yet. I mean, you're talking about you worked out a compromise that seemed to work. Maybe Zawahiri says, I don't want your lawyers. I want to represent myself. And maybe he goes up to court and says, they frustrated my ability to represent myself because they wouldn't let me have the discovery.
Eddie.
In Padilla, a significant bulk of the classified material actually is interrogation, videotaping interrogations. The government really has access to it. Now, obviously, they were his interrogations. He knew what happened to them. But there was other classified information. Whatever it was with my client, and usually some kind of SEPA compromise, either the government would declassify it or some substitution.
Jim?
Just to make a quick comment, for those of you who are, to go back to your original question about things we should be thinking about, I mean, I don't know, it seems to me, for those of you writing about this topic and thinking about it, I guess I agree with Andy that the likelihood of this happening anytime soon is small. But you never know if there's another attack, what people will be thinking about. But in any event, I mean, I think what you're really talking about at the end of the day is creating a parallel legal system to that of the federal district courts and the courts of appeals. And if you think about a federal court in terms of sort of